checking in with her talented friend who writes for pretty much every publication on the planet and makes them better through his efforts, Colin Fleming, joining us. Colin, good afternoon.
You're lit up behind the microphone again, I see.
Every single day, yeah. Got to do what you got to do. FCC, their deregulation is well, it's our party, as it turns out.
One powers through.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, this time around, we're talking about a strange confluence of holiday season and some really fantastic horror movies that happen to come out at the same time.
Right. I think it's, like you mentioned, curious that someone in marketing back in, as relevant for our conversation here in the 30s and 40s, said, you know what? Christmas, people are in good spirits. The eggnog is flowing. Let us have some terror cinema to bust in upon that mood. So one of those films we have is 1932's The Mummy, which starred Boris Karloff. And this is after Frankenstein the year before, when Karloff did an awful lot of grunting, really. It was a great acting performance, I think, but it stemmed from his ability to emote sans words. Whereas in The Mummy, he is briefly that bandaged fellow at the very beginning in one of the creepiest scenes you will ever encounter. And then he has a very almost chatty role as someone pining for his lost love from the days before Christ and everything.
Yeah, The Mummy is so good. And I think of those you mentioned, it's one that maybe it feels to me like fewer people have seen for some reason, maybe because of the literary lineage of Frankenstein.
It's a little talky in the sense that you have to settle in and become ensconced in its mood, I would say. But watching it again recently, and I've probably seen it 50 or 60 times, I'm struck by how well it's aged. It doesn't get nearly the pub that Frankenstein gets, Dracula gets. Dracula, very creaky, very stagey. The cinematographer on Dracula was actually Carl Freund, who directs The Mummy. And he was a very poetic, fluid cinematographer. And he brings that to bear in his directing style here. It's not even as well known as Bride of Frankenstein. And I think part of that is because, like I said, you have this scene at the beginning where the archaeologists, they've gone into the tomb, and this isn't very long after the whole notion of curses and tombs was playing in the news cycle, as we now call it. That's what was happening back then. And Karloff awakens, he animates basically, and through just a trailing lone bandage, there is this moment that will just push you through the back end of your seat. Even now, you watch it, it's terrifying. Then later, this is right in the early era of talkie pictures. So 3 years before, this would have been a silent. There are these flashback sequences. It's very clever how they do this, where they take place in silence, almost like it's a movie commentary on the age that just ended.
10 years later, one of my absolute favorites. To me, it's always felt like a film noir version of horror, Val Lewton's Cat People. It's such an amazing film.
It feels like a film noir version of horror because the cinematography is by Nicholas Musoraka, who did the cinematography on Out of the Past, where people on the set said it was though the set was lit with matches. That's how dark everything was. So we have now, basically, we're at RKO. Orson Welles has had his fall from grace, where he's put the studio in a financial hole. And the new phrase is out with genius, in with showmanship, which is kind of insulting to everyone on this film. It was produced by Val Lewton. It's directed by Jacques Tourneur, who also did Out of the Past. They worked together a lot. And there are hallmarks of a Lewton-produced film that become established right here with Cat People. The premise basically is this guy loves a woman, and whenever she gets really irked or aroused, she becomes a cat. But a cat like a panther that will split your jugular. So it's just bad scene all around. Everyone has bad ex story. This guy has a really bad one. And we see these devices that show up in Lewton films again and again. One of them is the Lewton walk, where a character goes off and is just, think of how big budgeted everything is now. Like, we have to pay money to involve our imaginations, which isn't true. So and Cat People, someone gets off a bus, goes for a walk, and just through the orchestration of sounds, terror is induced in us, and there's this jolt moment that became a hallmark of his films going forward.
And I was reading that they shot Cat People in just a little over 3 weeks and reused a lot of sets, including, you mentioned Orson Welles, the staircase from Magnificent Ambersons.
Yes, this is the low-rent version of that earlier opulence, basically. And it was one of those, like in England, they had what were called quota quickies. This was almost the American version of a quota quickie. The most famous scene, and again, it's one of the most efficacious in all of terror cinema, involves simply a pool, someone in it at night. It's like a YMCA pool. It's not even like a nice pool. I don't know. I hope they have enough chlorine here. I shouldn't be going into this. And just the shadows on the wall and some sound, right, which we could reproduce with like $10 and have money left over for a Dunkin' Donuts coffee. So the way they did that was just this masterful work of light and shade and darker blacks, lighter blacks, and letting your imagination have free range, basically. And it's really cool, too, because there's a doctor in this film, a Dr. Judd, and he gets slain by Simone's character, who plays this cat woman, basically. And he shows up, the same character. He shows up later on in the Ludin film chronology in The Seventh Victim, which is a proto version of Rosemary's Baby. And I think it's a better version of that kind of Satanist type of story. Hugh Beaumont, of all people, is in it. You'll remember him as the father on Leave It to Beaver, always chastising the beaver. And again, it's just kind of the Ludin crew, the Ludin gang, pioneering these terror hallmarks that really no one else did but him.
And you mentioned the tone of the feel of that film and then the use of the great cinematography. And to me, that's one of the things that didn't translate with the 80s version with Nastassja Kinski. It just, to me, didn't work anywhere near as well in color.
1982 was a weird year for horror remakes because you have this one, and I agree, it doesn't work. It's almost like the remake, although it's a comedy remake, of The Old Dark House, which is another Boris Karloff film. And it's like, what's going on here? The same year, you had a remake of Howard Hawks' The Thing, John Carpenter remake. And it's a completely different film, same source material, and that works. But with Cat People, I don't know. It's almost like the remake of The Haunting. You see like the 1963 version, and you see that version that's always on like TNT in the middle of the night.
That's right.
And it's like, well, this is just, I know that you want to kind of be different, but it's not homage, it's not different, it's not a riff on it, it just kind of falls to bit.
Now, we're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. A couple of years after Cat People, most of the cast reunited, albeit with a different director, for Curse of the Cat People.
That would be Robert Wise directing that one, and he would go on to, he directed The Haunting in 1963, based on that Shirley Jackson novel, The Haunting of Hill House. Great film if you've never seen it. He directed the first Star Trek film in the 70s, and he was Orson Welles' editor. He actually had worked to kind of salvage Ambersons, which you referenced, and they kind of had somewhat of a falling out for a little bit over that. But it's a very different film, Curse of the Cat People, and I don't think anyone has ever really known how to classify it. Because it was supposed to be this sequel of like, oh, you thought cat people were bad before, get a load of them now. But really, it's about a lonely girl who is bullied in some ways. But it's like gentle bullying for the cinema. It's not malicious like Facebook, right, stalking and this happened to you, this hell on the bus. But it's kind of like as far as Hollywood could go in that direction. And she essentially invents, maybe, we don't know. We never really know. It's like a Henry James story, Turn of the Screw. We never really know, right? Which is part of the horror in some sense. She invents a friend. And the friend is, lo and behold, Simone, who had been our cat person with her various issues of anger and arousal, who befriends her in the backyard, basically, where she plays games of make-believe. And it becomes kind of this plot of trying to get her father, to believe that she's not coming undone, basically. I feel like it's a way of coping. And in some ways, it's a very heartfelt picture. It's set at Christmas, even though it didn't come out until the spring. But it's almost like where we all go to at some point in our lives, starting when we're children, to deal with things. Some of us step back a little bit and unwind through whatever our hobbies might be. Other people descend into things that are far less helpful for them that they don't really climb out of. And you get the sense with this little girl that she's going to be fine. And this is just a coping mechanism for this period of her life.
Great film. So worthy of being viewed again, or for the first time, if you haven't seen them before, not only this holiday season when they were released, but any time of year. Colin Fleming with us. And next week on the program, I love this. We're going to talk about ghost stories and Christmas time and the English love of pairing them up.
If you were an English person, you were a professor like M.R. James, one of our subjects, you would sit there and think, oh, yes, it's Christmas. I will write a terrifying story. Then I will invite colleagues to my room. And some of my favorite students, not in this kind of, like, bad way that gets you in trouble now. Everyone's coming around the candlelight to hear the story. And you would read your ghost story. And, in fact, many of our most beloved classic ghost stories from the Victorian period, the Edwardian period, the post-war period, originate not from Halloween, not from the Dead Night of the Soul, but from Christmas.
We'll talk about it all next week with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Thanks, Colin. We'll see you next time.
All right. Sounds good.